This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Hey, hockey fans! Can't get enough hockey? Then get more with Team USA. When you crave the fast-paced, hard-hitting action on the ice, but you don't always love the big league price, then Team USA has you covered with all the thrills and all the energy at USA Hockey Arena in Plymouth, and all at a family-friendly price. Get more fun and more hockey when Team USA hosts exciting NCAA, international, and USHL opponents. Grab your tickets now at usahockeyntdp.com and see America's NHL stars of tomorrow.
Hello and welcome to the Outdoor Podcast. I'm Dave Thomas. Thank you so much for tuning in to this show. Before we get started, we want to say a special thanks to the companies who helped make this show possible. And those companies include Easton Archery, Gas Bowstrings, Burris, The Bow Hitch, Scott Archery, and Trophy Ridge. Also, special shout out to Deer Camp Coffee for keeping us caffeinated throughout the show and keeping us entertaining for you. The Outdoor Podcast was created and produced by BowhunterPlanet.com. If you ever want to learn archery, please check out BowhunterPlanet.com and you get a minute to learn the skills you need to become an archer or a bow hunter. And now, on to the show. Hey guys, welcome to the show today. Dave Thomas here from Bowhunter Planet in our Outdoor Podcast. And with the show today, we have Sarah and Josh Bomar talking about a lot of different topics today, but I have a lot of questions for you guys, and a lot of my questions are regards to hunting, of course. You have some amazing adventures you guys have done, but I wanted to give you the floor first, as we kind of talked about in the pre-show here, just to kind of explain, like, the backstory of the Bomars. Like, because honestly, I was thinking about it before you guys were coming on. I was like, I don't really know their backstory. Like, who got them in the archery? Why did they even get into the business of archery and bow hunting, and what drives you guys for that? So I'll just give it to you guys to tell us the story. I know it's probably going to be a little bit winded, but let's hear it.
Hey, first of all, Dave, thanks for having us on. This is going to be so fun, and happy to answer all your questions. And our backstory is actually pretty cool. So,
are you going first?
Yeah, I mean, we'll kind of start, and I'll kind of give my story up to when I met Sarah, and then Sarah can kind of run with it. It's kind of fun.
Yeah.
But Bomar, my last name, I come from a whole lineage of bow hunters. Like, my grandpa wrote a book on bow hunting, Big White Tails. He was killing giants back in the 70s and 80s, where you would walk around in Ohio and find one set of deer tracks, and he was killing Boone and Crockett's with a bow and arrow, with no sights. And, yeah, I mean,
one, your grandma was the first woman in the Ohio Big Buck Club.
Yeah, my grandma was the first woman in the state of Ohio to shoot one over 140, and it was a giant. It was the largest buck ever killed in the state for, like, 20 years. Jeez. By a female. Very, very huge, typical 170 inches, which is really special. Like, it netted, I think, 170 as a typical. So pretty special deer. And so I grew up bow hunting. And my grandpa and dad were real hard on me. You know, I wasn't allowed to kill my first deer with sights. So bow hunting, I had to shoot instinctive.
Wow.
And so I killed my first deer with a bow, shooting instinctive with no sights. And it was crazy, you know, growing up that way. But I appreciated archery at a very high level. Guns were for sissies. You know, we bow hunted strictly. And my family, we did gun hunt, you know, a little, but not much. We were diehard bow hunters. And so I grew up with great teachers, with my dad and my grandpa. And I always loved filming my hunts. And so I was very fortunate to have a pastor who had a TV show. And he filmed, like, a fishing show. And he had this old camera that he wasn't using. And he gave it to me as kind of like my first camera to, like, film my stuff with. And so that was really special. And I filmed all my stuff. You can go back to our YouTube. And I started YouTube in 2008 or 9. So very, very long time ago. And I was filming my hunts in high school. And they're so cringy, but they're fun. And what kind of got my start in popularity was hunting with a homemade longbow, because a lot of people don't know this, but I strictly hunted with a homemade bow for 5
wow.
years. I didn't even have a compound. I sold it because I didn't have any money. So I needed the money. And so I built my own bow and I hunted with that. And I shot multiple Pope and Young animals and a bear and some whitetails, and filming those, it was so unique and different because no one really ever did that back then. And so that kind of got my start in popularity, was the stick bow stuff. But then where that stopped was I missed about a 210 to 215 with it. Total target panic, freak out, buck fever. I mean, all of it came in on me at once and I just blew the whole thing. I mean, it was so funny. And I learned so much from that buck. I'm very grateful. But he was blind in one eye, had a broken leg that healed crooked. I mean, he was crippled, old, and I still couldn't kill him. It was just as terrible. And I finally got my shot. And whenever I shot, it was so funny with my longbow. I couldn't stop looking at his antlers, and my arrow went right between his antlers.
Hey, at least you hit one, breaking off.
Right. I ended up finding his shed, and his one antler scored 102. Wow. If that tells you how big this deer was. So yeah, after that, I hung up the longbow and picked up the compound, which would have been about 2013. And then I met Sarah in 2014. And so you can kind of pick up with this, because this is crazy. If a lot of people are watching this, don't know this story. This is where it gets wild.
Well, I think too, before we jump out of your story, you also took a lot of media broadcast journalism classes in college, which I think a lot of people like look at our YouTube and they're like, oh, overnight success and all these things. And it's like, no, there's so much work that went into like high school and college and beyond too.
Well, yeah, because I edited all my own content for 8 years. We didn't have editors or teams or anything like that. So I did take a media and broadcast journalism class, and I had to talk to, like, with the dean of our university in order to be able to even get into it, because it was a senior level class. And I explained what my dreams were, and they were so cool to be able to let me in there. But I didn't get credit for it is the problem. I didn't get the credit for the class, but I was like, I don't care. You know, I just want to take the class, because I was an exercise physiology guy in kinesiology. So I studied all the health and fitness, and, you know, Sarah and I are both, you know, fitness nutrition specialists, and we are more specialists on the fitness side with, in terms of income and things like that. And so that's what I studied in school, but I was always a diehard deer hunter, you know, and fisherman. And so it was kind of funny, but yeah, that's cool. But
so Josh and I met at the Arnold in 2014, which is the biggest fitness bodybuilding expo in the world. He broke the golden rule and approached me at the gym while I was working out. And
I've seen the horror videos of those type of things.
That was me. Yeah. I couldn't help myself. It was 9 o'clock at night and everyone else was at the bars or the clubs or whatever everyone's doing. And I was in the gym training and so was she. And I was like, that's a girl I want to talk to, because if she's at the gym and not out at the bars, like, this is someone I want to get to know. And so that's why I hit on her. But
you at least waited until I was almost finished with my
workout. Well, I was trying to time a water bottle, but she'd never get a drink. So it just got awkward.
Yeah.
She's like, you know what? I'm just going to talk to her.
So the Arnold's in Columbus. Josh lived there. I did not, but I was in town for the show. So that's why it was just crazy. Like, we're both at the gym, same time, Saturday night of this huge expo, ended up just really hitting it off. And so that was Saturday. The show is Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And so that next day he was like, oh, I'll swing by your booth, I'll come see you, whatever. And I'm like, okay, like, is this guy really going to do that? And he actually did, swung by the booth and ended up knowing the owner of the company that I was working with, which is so funny. He came to our wedding. But
he was a big hunter, and his name was Dave, too, which is fun.
A lot of Daves out there.
He's from Pennsylvania. But so Josh swung by the booth and, you know, was like, let's just go grab food. The show's pretty dead on Sunday. So we went to – our first date was the food court at the convention center downtown Columbus.
This is where it gets really crazy.
Yeah. And so obviously the day before we hadn't talked about like dietary preferences, because who would, but that day when we were ordering, Josh was like, why are you only ordering a vegan meal? Like, why are you not eating meat? And I was like, I don't eat meat. I haven't eaten meat for 2 years. And immediately he was like, this is not
gonna work. So you're a vegan. I'm like, you're a vegan. I'm a diehard hunter. I kill animals and eat them. And I told her right there on our first date, I'm sorry, this just isn't going to work out.
Yeah.
You know, I was like, you're beautiful, but listen, this is what I do. And she dropped that bomb on me. And I was like, this is not working. But she said, hey, I'm not against hunting.
Yeah.
I'm just against the meat packing industry and all of that. And so there was where I was like, okay, there's a little sliver of hope. But I'm not holding my or crossing my fingers for this one.
Yeah. So I was fresh out of college and just still really care about animal welfare, which we both do. And I think a lot of people don't understand that hunters actually really do love animals. And so it's cool that we haven't purchased meat from the store since pretty much meeting. And so Josh took a very calm and like educational approach to archery and conservation. And in my head, I'm like, okay, well, this guy's really hot. I did archery once in fifth grade camp. Like, oh, I would totally shoot something. And so that was the first weekend of March. And by April 1st, I quit my job in Toledo, moved down to Columbus, and started just entrepreneurship, the fitness side, from day one, both of us. And it was funny because turkey season was coming up. And so we're like, well, let's go get a bow and see if you can actually draw this thing back, if you can aim, how you do with it. So we ended up going to our favorite pro shop in Columbus, Fisherman's Warehouse, and they taught me to shoot. That is the number one thing that I can recommend to anyone who's wanting to get their wife or girlfriend or partner into archery or hunting.
You skipped over a very important part, though, that I want to cover. So turkey season is in April, and she's wanting to try to hunt turkeys. And I'm like, you have no chance of learning how to shoot a bow in 2 weeks and expect to shoot one. I'm like, so I'm going to get you my turkey gun, and we're going to see if you can shoot. So it's a 12-gauge with 3.5 turkey loads.
I've never shot a gun before.
And she's never shot a gun. And I first one, 12-gauge, 3.5 turkey loads. We don't have time for the pleasantries. We got turkey season coming. So I give her the gun, you know, and I'm going to like, she's going to flinch so bad. So I acted like I loaded it, you know, to put it in there to see how bad she flinched. And so it was just a blank. And so I'm like, all right, so put the bead on, put your head on the barrel until you can't see any of the barrel. And the only thing you see is the bead. I said, put the bead then on the turkey's head. It was a target, and pull the trigger. So I'm watching, you know, I'm like, oh, she's going to go real bad. She literally is a serial killer because she went like this, click, and didn't even blink. I kid you not. She didn't even blink. She's like, why didn't it go off? I'm like, whoa, this is crazy. So then I loaded it, you know, and she's like 110 pounds. Yeah. And boom, and it blasts. And she's like, oh my God, this is horrible. I'm like, you missed.
No,
I'm like, try again. And she shoots it again. She's like,
rips my shoulder.
Forget this gun thing. We're going to get in the boat. And I'm like, okay. I was like, so you've got a lot to learn in a very short period of time.
Yeah. So we were living in an apartment at the time and had no access to like a target or a course or anything. And so we were shooting 10, 11 o'clock at night in our parking lot at the apartment complex. And luckily the security guy was like, okay, like I'm a hunter too. I get it. But like, these are like weapons. You guys are in like a very nice part of Columbus. Like, just make sure that no one sees you.
We were in Dublin, Ohio. Like, so it was not a place you shoot bow and arrows in parking lots.
But
we didn't have any choice, you know, that's what we had.
No one told me how difficult archery hunting a turkey would be. And I'm grateful for that because I feel like I've gotten in my own head. And we went down to Kentucky and had no luck. And then Ohio
City, knocking doors, no permission, just... And this is a great tip for anyone watching this. If you want to just get permission, tell them you're only going to be there for a day.
Yeah.
And like, I'm only going to hunt for today, maybe tomorrow. Would you mind if I tried to get a turkey? And we got a lot of permission that way. I bet you we were about 50%, which is really high.
Yeah.
If you've ever knocked doors, it's normally 100% no's. And someone forgets. And I mean, you get one person that maybe lets you go. But we were 50%. Like, listen, we're only going to be here till tomorrow. Would you mind if we tried? And we'll speed up the story because I don't want to bore everybody with this, but the short end of this is she started shooting her bow, but she got trained by guys that weren't me. And so she was like learning really well, really fast. And she's hitting the bullseye over and over again. I'm like, she's got a chance here. And I'm like, listen, even back then, this is 2014. I'm like, I only shoot turkeys in the head. So we're only shooting them in the head. She didn't know any better. So We go to the spot. Sure enough, I call in this whole group of toms, and they're thumping the decoy, you know, and the one standing breeding the decoy, and its head's doing this. And I'm like, all right, shoot him in the head, you know. And then his head's down, and I start calling. He sticks his head up, and I kid you not, she shoots this thing straight in the head. First time. Just domes it. Boom! It just, and it starts flopping around. I'm like, and she's a vegan. A vegan. Still,
yeah, I still haven't eaten meat.
She still hadn't eaten meat. She just shoots his turkey in the head.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh wow, right then and there, I'm like, I'm gonna marry this girl. This is insane. Even from the very first time she ever pulled the trigger on the gun and didn't blink to the time that's ice in her veins when it comes to shooting. And I was so impressed. And so the first time she ate meat in years was her own turkey.
Yeah. Which was so did Sarah, did you grow up in the city then or in the country too?
Oh yeah, I grew up in Southern California, like the ocean, the most like non-hunting. Now my grandpa farmed, raised bison, that kind of thing, but no one in my family hunts. Like I was not exposed to it at all. So it's really cool now to, and I think this is something that like we really pride ourselves on, is how we can explain hunting to people, because it's not something that I've been doing my whole life. It's not a my way or the highway kind of thing. I can take it from, guys, I was a literal vegan and now I am a bow hunter and we've traveled all over the world. So it's really cool to be able to have that, like that side of the viewership and just really the ignorance to it, because it's not taught. It's not something that many people, you know, talk about. It's not on TV hardly unless you're actively looking for it. So It is, social media has been really cool just to have that interaction with people on sharing our story.
Yeah. And really to fast track to kind of where we are, I would say now, 2014, Sarah and I were filming each other. We filmed our hunts. We started gaining more and more popularity with social media, and our YouTube videos started catching more traction. And then our social media, we quit doing Facebook, we quit doing everything. We put all of our effort into Instagram. Yeah. And so this was back when Facebook was still hot. It was kind of like TikTok is compared to Instagram now. We abandoned Facebook and went all in. And we were really the only people. So we grew really fast with our style of content. So we got to 100,000 followers pretty fast. And we started getting fans, which was really cool. And then we just put more and more effort into our stuff. And it just took a really, really long time. But in 2016, we made a very unique decision for people in our space, is we abandoned all sponsorships. And so we were real sponsor heavy, and it just bothered me so much, because whenever I would make a video and we're filming this hunt, I'm like, oh man, I got to make sure I got Hoyt in here. I got to make sure I got Nomad. I got to make sure I got this broadhead and this company. And next thing you know, I'm editing it, and all of a sudden, the hunt becomes about what I'm using, not what I'm hunting. And that was the moment I drew the line. I said, we're not doing this, because I want this not to be about what I'm using. I want it to be about the animal and its story and its journey and the trials and tribulations that we're going through in order to harvest this animal. Because bow hunting is hard. And, you know, you watch our videos and it makes it feel easy. And you watch TV shows, but it makes it feel easy because you're seeing all this time condensed down into this edit, when it's really, really hard. And I was like, I don't want to dilute this down to just this big sponsorship heavy episodes. And so in 2016, and this was a lot of money for us, but we were making probably close to 80 grand a year with all of our sponsors, and we cut all of them. And we said, we're just going to shoot what we want, wear what we want, and do whatever we want to be sponsor free.
Well, I think that was too, we were getting ready for an Alaska hunt for caribou, and who we were with at the time didn't have the gear we needed. And it's like, bow hunting is hard enough. We don't want to limit ourselves to the equipment that's available through this one sponsor when we really need this to have a successful hunt. So yeah, it's been sponsor free ever since.
Yeah. So, I mean, for almost 10 years, you know, and eight years now we've been sponsor free. We only promote our own products and products that we're using legitimately. And so it's kind of interesting, but it's definitely, I'm not saying if people have sponsors, that's bad by any means. You can only work with companies that you truly believe in. And that's totally great too. But for us, we just decided to cut all ties with it all
together. Yeah. That's interesting, actually. I noticed that because I was looking at, you know, your stuff, and I thought, I just realized they have zero sponsors. That's very interesting. And I thought, well, they're big enough now, it doesn't really matter for you. But, you know, I was thinking about that concept, like why you just said that. And I thought, you know, unless you're like a person who is totally dedicated to one brand. So like, for instance, somebody who shot Hoyt, that's been shooting Hoyt for years and loves Hoyt to death, you know, type person, then it makes a little more sense, I think, for a connection overall. But I feel like it would be hard to do that nowadays, just with social the way it is. It just, it doesn't come off the same. And I think when you see people jump so fast to different brands, it's kind of like a bad taste, you know, we don't actually take any bow sponsors at all, because we try to keep it very open-ended for us to have consumers from all different brands come and hang out and do stuff with archery, right? Other stuff will get sponsors, but not specifically bows. And that's why we do that, because people, for some reason, people lock onto the bow thing the most, right? If you say tomorrow,
the bows.
If you guys say tomorrow, oh, we're signing with Matthews, and you're going to lose every PSC person ever liked you, every elite person, whatever. Just the way it goes. I don't know what it is about this industry, but that is exactly how it goes every time. And when people jump so much, I think it looks a little bad too, because they'll be like, oh, I can shoot this bow and make, you know, whatever, hundreds of thousands of dollars and shoot this one and do it in this one. And I don't know. I'd rather do it the way you're doing it. I think it's the best way. Cause like, if you could just control your own destiny and not have to worry about these guys and just shoot what you want, I think that's the way to go.
Yeah. Yeah. And so again, nothing against the people that sponsor. It's the people that I don't like are the people that take a sponsor just for the money and they don't even like the product. Yeah. I mean, cause when you see some of the things I've seen where people are sponsored by another company and they sponsored by Broadhead, for example. Broadhead's a great example. And then they use something different, but they edit in the sponsored product. Like, that's the stuff where I'm like, man, you're misleading people, and that's not right. And but they also got bills to pay, so I'm understanding to why people do this, but I just never wanted to go down that rabbit hole. It felt inauthentic to me, and just not what I wanted.
We even see it in the fitness space too, like, because sometimes I'll get on and like see who's ordering and stuff. And there have been times where I see other athletes, like some of my friends that work with other companies ordering our stuff. And I'm just
like, uh-oh. But that's, it's fine. But no, anyway, so that's, and then, you know, the finish that story, we grinded and grinded and grinded with very little to show for it for years and years and years. And then finally it was last spring, we grew to, it would have been March, we were hit 100 million views on YouTube and 300,000 subscribers. I'll never forget it because we did a post about this. We're like, we just hit 100 million views. You know, this is so cool. And then we found something very interesting. I noticed when we were creating shorts, the shorts were getting a lot more traction. They were living in a different algorithm than the long form videos. And it made sense to me because now YouTube was trying to compete with TikTok and Instagram. And so they were really pumping this stuff. And I noticed no one else in the hunting space is like really doing a lot with shorts. So we went all in the past 12 months into shorts. And like, this is pretty cool. We just got this in. And we went from, so that's, we got the gold play bucket or button.
So jealous. Cool. That is amazing.
Oh, very, very proud.
We I went just want the silver 300,000. I just want the first one.
Yeah, that
it did take a while though for our silver one to come.
Yeah,
So the silver one, we got the 100,000. So this was a big one for us. But what was crazy was we put all that effort into there, and we went from 100 million views to just under 800 million views in less than a year, and then went from 300,000 subscribers to 1.9 million at the time of this recording subscribers. But a lot of that's from shorts, and so now we're transferring all of our energy back into the long form, you know, and we're still doing shorts, but long form is where, you know, you create the raving fans, and it's not just about subscribers and that value and content.
Yeah. That's interesting, because you're in a position now where you have to really think this through, because like you're saying, now I have to figure out how to keep these 1.9 million people happy, right? And like you're saying, it's a great point. So now, okay, shorts were one thing, but now I got to really come up with this content to keep them happy and, you know, and going. And I, you know, honestly, I didn't realize you guys had 1.9 million until I was looking through all this. And I was like, oh my God, that's it. That's really impressive, honestly, for a hunting or archery type thing, honestly. Like, so hats off to you guys. That is like literally not easy to do. In fact, a lot of the people with that kind of volume or the people I follow are like true crime stuff I love to watch. So like, I'm like, oh, cool, man. That chapter got to 1.5, you know, I never realized anybody in the hunting space had over a million, to be honest. So like, that's why I was like, oh my God, like that's up there with the, that's really cool to see. So
thank you. Yeah, we actually just passed I think it was Meat Eater who had the largest hunting channel in the world, and we just passed it. So in terms of like bow hunting, especially in just hunting in general that only do hunting, like we have the largest YouTube
channel. Wow. That's really cool. Now if you could just get Mr. Beast to do something with you.
Right? Well, hey, we're gonna keep growing, you know. And a lot of it had to do with that camera too, that we got with the slow motion and our editing styles. We're just trying to evolve and model, honestly, how Mr. Beast does it. And even our content, you'll see, is very different, unique. with our long form, we've really stepped up our production quality trying. But what I'm finding is the production quality, I don't know if the people are liking that as much as just the raw hunting public style, mm-hmm. you know?
But Easton match-grade shafts undergo a far more meticulous straightness check with razor tolerance at both ends, the center, and the critical quarter locations. Discover the ultimate in precision and made in USA quality. Visit your authorized Easton dealer and pick up your Easton match-grade Pro Shop Series arrows today.
Established in a small town in Kentucky in 1981, a company that produces quality products that archers have come to rely on. I started shooting with a Scott release and have passed the tradition on. As I've aged, the company I started with continues to innovate and produce the premium products it always has. My dad always told me, never forget where you came from. Well, I haven't. Shoot with confidence. Shoot a Scott.
For more than 20 years, Trophy Ridge has developed tools that bow hunters trust and continue to lead the way in bow hunting innovation. Our field-proven products dish out dirt naps all over the world. We've manufactured and sold millions of products along the way, each one strategically designed to give you a distinct advantage in the field. From the backyard and competitive courses, to the backcountry and Midwest cornfields, our products remain lethal, accurate, and continue to help you react to the situation at hand. Trophy Ridge accessories give you confidence, regardless of the situation. Our sights, rest, stabilizers, quivers, and releases set you up to be successful season after season. There are plenty of factors to think about on the hunt. Your gear shouldn't be one of them. We're Trophy Ridge, and we build the tools that bow hunters trust.
We are outdoors people, boating, fishing, hunting, and we are coffee lovers. My husband and I, we met at a coffee shop about 20 years back. So we've grown to love different blends, different beans, and different types of coffee. And throughout our time together, we decided that we wanted to create something for ourselves. So that's where this all came into play. even though that this location is in the heart of Macomb County, it's in Sterling Heights, Michigan. We are known nationwide and overseas and in Canada. This location specifically, we had a lot of other Made in Michigan and Macomb County residents that were in the same boat. So they came walking through our doors as well. And so what you see here today is just a culmination of different vendors, products, partnerships, and Made in Michigan products in our store today. We have our hunting line buck baits, which is lures and attractants. And we also have Uncle Henry's gourmet meats, which is wild game, jerkies. We have Honey, Great Lakes Pickling Company, which is a Macomb County partner, Williams Cheese, Youper Bars, and Mackinac Island Fudge. People come here for that as well. When customers come in, if they're new, they don't know what to expect, and they always get greeted with, "Welcome to Deer Camp." And then they start looking around. They start realizing it's a lot of home products that they have in their house, maple syrups and coffee. And it's not just an outdoorsman, it's women, men, children. It's the community that come in here and they like it. They sit down at our cafe. They might have a venison hot dog, a cold brew coffee, and they enjoy their time here.
I'm not sure that the really crazy hard editing on the long form is really what people like. So we're learning and evolving for sure, just like everyone else.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
That's how I feel like I am. I'm always chasing, like trying to figure out where to go next. The one thing we did do right was TikTok. We did get ahead of that one, and that grew pretty fast for us as well. And I enjoy TikTok a lot because I feel like, for me at least, for our stuff, is I get the most like comments and conversation and questions, and we'll go on there and do lives like all the time, and people are always on there and they're always asking questions. They're joining the membership, they're joining subscription, it's really interactive compared to the others where it's a little slower. YouTube's definitely getting better, and I think you're right, it has something to do with them trying to catch up to TikTok or whatever. Instagram and Meta, I'm just not really, I just, you know, they're very hard to work with. I you know, struggle with them guys. Struggle. That's the best word.
Yeah,
we all do.
I feel like TikTok is very niche. Like the once you tell it what you want to see, I feel like my For You page is like, oh my gosh, every single video speaks to me. So I feel like their algorithm and like what they send to each person is way more specific than what Instagram is. So I feel like that too, like, contributes to the conversation because everyone is just so like, this is my thing. This is all I want. Where you're not getting like, I don't know, just scroll the doom scrolling of all the stuff you don't want to see, and then by the time you're like, I'm gonna see that comment.
The bigger growth things I've seen, and I love talking social stuff, so just a heads up, sorry. That's why I'm like going on about this, but
well, all of us that are, you know,
the best thing I've seen, and this I got this from a friend of mine in high school. I played football with him in high school, and I haven't talked to him in years. And all of a sudden I'm on TikTok one day and I see him and I'm like, wow, that's Kevin Lawson. I'm like, that's weird. So I'm watching him and he's doing these pastor type things where like a Jesus type, you know, he's talking, he's like, hey, you know, how are you feeling today? Are you down? You know, like stuff like that. And then he kind of goes into like, you know, and I'm like, wow, it was kind of inspiring. I watched it. I'm like, wow, that's pretty good. So then I go to his thing. It says 1.5 million followers on TikTok. I'm like, wow. Right. And so then literally I'm like, that's pretty cool. And you know, so whatever. Long story short, like maybe let's say 6 months goes by. I go back. He's at like 5.6 million. I'm like, what the heck? Wow. And then, so I look into it. I'm just like, I got to figure this out. Like, how did he grow like that? And then it turns out they did the smartest thing I've ever seen. Like they took 10 or 6 or 10 collaborated 10, like all these guys that do the same concepts, all have a million followers each. They rented a house and they filmed tons of stuff and they all went up like dramatically based on, I was like, that is genius. You know, I'm like, that is one of the smartest things I've ever seen. Gamers do it too. Gamers do collaborations like that.
Yeah. You don't see that a whole lot in the hunting space.
Not at all.
I don't know.
That might be a battle royale.
They should, you know.
That'd be a good show. You're right.
Yeah, I think we're all so competitive. Like, I'm the type of guy that wants everyone to win, so I'm just like, I'm rooting for everybody. So I'm extremely competitive when the competition is there. But to me, I don't feel like hunting's competitive. You know, it's like I'm just chasing deer that only I'm chasing, and I expect my neighbors are too, obviously. But you know, at the end of the day, it's just me with the
maybe deer. That's your episode, though. You open up your one deer to like 10 guys to come in and hunt it against you.
Yeah, that deer behind me had about 20 dudes trying to kill that thing. And so I hated that feeling. That it was the worst.
That thing's a monster.
Yeah, wow. That's oh, God. It's a fun episode if you go on to check it out.
Let's shift gears just a little bit and talk about Africa. I mean, you're talking about a whole different type of hunting. And, you know, I don't know much about that side of it, so I'm going to let you guys kind of take it away. But I will say the things I have heard from people that have been there that in through the industry I've talked to. One guy was talking about I think he was going to the bathroom or something under a tree. And, like, the guide's like, don't move. And he's like, what do you mean? He's like, don't move. And he's like, what's going on? And he's like, I don't know. I might have this wrong. But he said there was is it a black mamba? Is that like the danger snake? Is that the one that stands up like a stick and it'll chase you or something? Whatever one does that, he's like, that's above you. It's in the tree above you. And the guy's like, I'm out of here. And I was like, he's telling me the story. We're on a hunt in Texas. He's telling me the story. I'm like, oh my God. But he said that it was the scariest thing ever. He said one bite and you were donezo. That's what he was saying. So
everything in Africa wants to kill you. I mean, Africa is a big serial killer. Everywhere you go. It is, it's like Texas, but way worse. But no, I mean, whatever you want to talk about with this, I mean, we totally can. The last two times we've been to Africa was Tanzania focused, which we shot a lot of amazing animals. We went to Uganda this year, which was really cool. I got super sick, which we could talk about. I thought I was going to die. And
what happened? I mean, how'd you get sick? Like, what'd you get?
I got malaria one, which. But then I got a bacterial and a parasitic infection. So I was literally shitting 20 times a day. Yes. But it's so bad. But not just that. It was blood.
Oh, my God.
Like, horrible.
How did you think it could have been from anything? Like eating something or water or anything? Or you guys don't know, but it could have been anything.
I was in the swamps chasing crocodiles, you know. And so when I killed my croc, I got malaria because we were hunting next to, like, this village. Well, the village was, it was like a mile away, but it was in the same kind of like swamp area where the lake ecosystem is. And so I'm assuming one of those people is where the mosquito got malaria and got me, because malaria is very rare in Tanzania. Wow. And so it's weird that I got
there.
Crazy. But yeah, I got super sick and it compromised my immune system, which then I got the parasitic infection.
That sounds fun.
I lost all, dude, it was bad. I thought it was gonna
jeez. Die. But, so what are the tell me about the animals you guys harvested while you were there.
We shot a lot. It was kind of
The second trip we killed like 50.
Holy cow.
You haven't even posted
half. Oh my God.
So we've been to Africa 5 times. So the first 2 times we went to South Africa, which is great. It has its place. But then we were like, well, we want to do something completely different. So the third time we went to Mozambique, which was amazing. It was all free range. It was so swampy. We were in like these amphibious vehicles the whole time that could go over water, which was really neat.
And affordable for what it was.
Yeah, Mozambique was. And then the last 2 trips we've done Tanzania. So you were there for 8 weeks. And then this year we were there for 6 weeks and then did like 10 days in Uganda.
Wow.
But just a lot of very unique animals. Like, you think you know African animals, then you go and you're like, what's that? Like, there's so many cool plains games and just different subspecies, but
and all of that hunting is 100% wild and free ranging, which is very hard.
How do you pack for that? I feel like that's a long time and a lot of gear.
So I literally bring 1 dozen arrows. That's it. And then I bring all the parts to make arrows when I'm there. So I pre-cut them all. And then because you need so many, then I build them in camp at night. And you just rewear your same clothes. They wash them every other day. You know, it's kind of
two bows each.
My last trip in Tanzania, I had a bow blow up on me.
Did you bring extra D loop, extra rest sights? I mean, everything.
Pretty much like when we went to Tanzania, between us, so our kids came with us, cameramen, everyone involved, all the camera bags, the archery equipment. It was 27 bags.
Oh my God.
A lot of mostly stuff. Camera gear.
Yeah.
Mostly
what kind of camera are you filming with for that? Like what, a Red or a...
For that, our main camera is the Sony A7S III. Yeah, okay. We film 4K 120 with a 24 to 240 lens typically. We did bring an Ursa Mini, which is a cinema camera. That films 4K 240 and 8K 120.
Wow. Holy cow.
So we filmed some of that, but then we also brought our Phantom camera, which is films extremely high speed, like 12,000 frames per second. So we used that in Uganda, which was really, really crazy.
That's cool.
But it's so expensive and so hard, you know, to put around because it's just, the whole system's like 80 pounds with the camera and you have to have the suitcase for a battery. Wow. It's not like a normal camera. It's universities. Yeah, literally universities buy this camera for research, and we're out there with it strapped to the truck.
It doesn't take 90 seconds to turn on.
Yeah, and 90 seconds to turn on, and that's with the newer one.
Do you ever figure out look into, and I've seen this, I don't know who did this, but I've seen it. They use that type of camera, but they also use some sort of mirror system to show the like a tank round in flight, and it's just going in flight.
I saw that on the slow-mo, guys. Yeah. They film like the mirror, yes. And then they can move the mirror at the same speed that the bullet flies. We should be able to do that with the
Rocket. I think so. Wouldn't that be cool, though? Because you would see it, like, you know, going with it. You know, you'd be going with it almost. Oh, yeah. Man.
Do it.
That'll be cool. We'll have to figure it out. That's a little above my physics.
I was talking to a friend of mine who does, he does, like, commercial stuff, and we're joking around, and I said, man, it would be so cool to see an arrow. I think you did this once. You put a GoPro on an arrow or something. I thought you did that one time. But either way.
Yeah, I did it on that.
I was wouldn't it look cool if you like saw it spinning, but the camera's not spinning. You know what I mean? Like the camera would sit still and it would. And so he's like, you know what you could do? He's like, you could put the arrow on a drill and just spin the drill. And I was like, that's a good commercial idea. Like, you know, like you see the arrow spinning.
That's actually
a good idea.
Right?
But then it'd be cool if they had like a bearing system where you could, that GoPro wouldn't move, you know, it just spin, the arrow would spin under it or something. That'd be sick.
Yeah, I tried to make the whole arrow camera thing, and it is very difficult. Technology's not quite there yet. It will be there, but it's just not there yet. So,
how many bones have you blown up or broken? Drones.
Oh God, I don't know. I'm not much of a drone guy. We've broken a few.
Broke one, sunk one.
Yeah, never take a drone off a moving boat. I learned that lesson right in the ocean. But no, it's I don't know. I mean, I'm definitely hard on all my equipment, my vehicles for sure. And just the reason why is I'm just an optimist. You know, I just believe it'll work out. I'm like, oh, I got this. I can get through this ditch. No, I can't. You know, so that's my 2024 goal, is to be less optimistic about my abilities.
I ask the drone question, everybody, because I feel like everybody who films videography or for hunting always has played with a drone, and I've crashed and burned about four of them. I probably lost 10 grand in drones. And I finally got a little one that's really great, but I don't use it a lot. You know, like you're saying, I don't use it a ton, but when I do, I'll never forget it, because the one clip I got, I actually got it for one of the companies that wanted this like feeder. And they're like, yeah, if you could get some video of this for us for our commercial, that'd be awesome. I'm like, yeah, I'd love to try and do it. So I pull out this awesome 360 on this thing, and I'm climbing and pulling out. So it looks cool. It's like this, like you're like going like this. And of course, I clip the top of a 50-foot tree, and that thing comes crashing down. Just boom, 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 hits the ground. And at the time, and I don't know if they fixed this. I think they have fixed this issue, but you will remember this. But at the time, because it didn't complete the process, the video was no good. It didn't close the video in the recording. I was like, oh my God, I didn't even get the shot. What a waste of thousands of dollars.
Oh, it's the worst.
Yeah.
Yeah. We, in Africa, we do deal with a lot of damaged equipment, mostly cameras and sand.
Yeah. You know, and dust. Jeez.
But over there, the places where you're hunting, you're driving around in a vehicle a lot. And most people are like, oh, that's terrible. Why would you hunt that way? Imagine if you had an entire state, the state you live in, you have that entire state to hunt, and it's all just for you. Like, that's how big some of these sections are. And you're like, how are you going to get around? You can't just leave camp and hike. How are you going to get 80 miles on the other side of this place?
Walk past how many lions and leopards and elephants and black mambas.
You do it. You drive around from spot to spot, then you spot and stop. You know, is kind of it.
And there are like better places for certain animals.
Yeah, just like your deer.
What are you guys using right now currently for bows? And you know, what's your go-to right now that you're liking in the industry?
Yeah.
So I am shooting the Hoyt RX-8. I just switched to that. Getting ready for a pretty big hunt this summer. So working my bow poundage up. And I'm now 70 pounds on that bow, which... is
amazing.
Really proud of you for that.
But Yeah, we were shooting. I had, when we went to Africa, I was shooting the same PSE bow for 2 years. Mm-hmm. So harvested a lot of animals with.
I liked PSE. Yeah. I shot them for a few years. I just, they kept breaking on me, to be honest, my limbs. And the last straw for me was whenever it was in Africa. And they pushed the limits, making me 90-pound bows and stuff like that. So I expected limb cracks and things, and it happened. But I never had a bow blow up on me. So I'd super glue the limb splinters down, and it worked. And I killed a lot of stuff with the PSE. So this is not a bash of PSE by any means, because I thought they make a great bow. And when I was in Africa shooting that bow, it was so dialed in. It was so perfect. And I was full draw, and the thing exploded. The limb broke, which then the yoke split, then twisted, and it flew out, went straight past my head, and then the whole bow went, and I was just like,
"Did you get that video?"
I was done, but I only had viral. In my left eye. I lose my right eye, I'm screwed, you know. And so that's where for me, I was like, okay. So I finished shooting that year, or finished hunting that trip with the Hoyt, and I wasn't as good with it as the PSE because it had less, it had 80% let off. I like 75%. I like bows that don't have, that have high holding weight. We can get into all that if you want with why I do it, but they're way more accurate, more holding weight. And so I dealt with a little bit of issues with it, but then, you know, that's just because I didn't shoot it a whole lot. I got it a week before I left. And then once I got dialed in, man, I liked the torque resistant aspect of their binary cam system, the way it was set up. It resisted torque, which was interesting. So I never missed left and right. It would, if anything, it would just be my up and downs. But that I could have fixed if I had more time, you know, messing with my D loop. Because how I go through my process from like a building a bow is I actually start with the bow completely naked and then work the D loop up or down until the bow aims as well as possible before I even do any stabilizers. Really cool technique for getting a bow to aim really well. That bow, I just kind of threw everything on it because it was a backup bow. I didn't expect to use it much. And so when I got to Tanzania and started using it, I was like, okay, I've got a lot of work to do with this thing. So I did it in camp and I got that thing freaking money. And I finished out the entire trip with it and it did really, really well for me. And so I was like, you know what? I think I'll try shooting their new Alpha X or whatever it is. And again, I got that bow shooting really well. It aims really well and it aims and shoots just as well as the PSE. So I've never had a Hoyt bow.
Is that 90 as well?
Like, okay. No, they won't make me a 90.
Do they have a 90?
That's
80. They have an 80?
Yeah, they make 80. They make Cam Haynes and Joe Rogan 90.
I was going to say, someone's got a 90. I could have swore Cam had something like that.
That's what they told me. They're like, listen, they got like 26-inch draw lengths. I have a 31-inch draw length. They're like, the bow is going to explode at 90 pounds. I'm like, it's not. I'm like, it's not.
They are good engineers, so I don't know. Maybe they know. I don't know.
They are, and they have that machine that they dry fire their bows.
Like, yeah, they're so crazy about how they test the product.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to HarlemGlobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
This is Michael Rosenbaum. Hey, folks, let me tell you that drinking and driving is a decision that will change your whole world. Things will never be the same once you get a DUI, because legal fees and time in court are just the beginning. Getting into a crash is another way your world could be irreversibly changed after drinking and driving. Your vehicle may not be the only thing that gets damaged in that crash. You could face a life-altering injury or even death. But you're not the only one who could face those consequences. Your decision to drink and drive could permanently change someone else's world, whether you injure them or leave their loved ones grieving. The next time you're out drinking, call a rideshare, a taxi, a sober friend, or a designated sober driver. Always plan for a safe ride home. The only decision that will change your world for the better is the decision to call for a sober ride. It's never worth it to drive drunk. Don't risk it. Drive sober or get pulled over. Paid for by NHTSA.
Passing, like they're integrity process is so intense. That's probably why they wouldn't make it. Where PSC were more gangsters. Yeah, they were like, we'll do it. Whatever you want, we'll
make
let's try it.
You
know, and that's awesome.
Whatever.
And I like that a lot about that brand, right? Because that's where innovation comes, is true. When you push the limits. And so I was cool with it. I love those guys over there. But, you know, I can't be on a Tanzania hunt in a bobo.
Yeah.
So that's where I'm like, I'll wait till they figure out their limb situation, lamination process, whatever, give it another year or two. Maybe I'll go back, or maybe I'll continue to shoot Hoyt. I don't know, but that's the point of being sponsor free. You know, I haven't shot the Matthews lift. Maybe I'll shoot that and really like it. But for what I'm trying to do and what Sarah's trying to do, I mean, with where we're going, we just, when we're, what we're hunting, you know, we've got a lot of time, energy, and money on this stuff, and mostly time. You know, we all do. Like, if we're chasing a big buck, we're going to get one chance. And a bow shooting 3 feet per second faster, but you're wondering if it's going to blow up on you or something like that. I
mean, not worth the risk.
Those are not worth it.
Have you guys had a chance to go to Hoyt or no?
Oh yeah, we've
been. Awesome.
Yeah, so we actually
I've been there once too.
We used to be. Yeah, it's awesome.
They have really good quality. I was really impressed with when they gave me the block of metal, and they're like, "All right, here's where it starts," you know, and then they see it cut it down. I'm like, damn, like this is what I'm talking about.
Yeah, it's cool. They're top notch.
They wouldn't show me the carbon side though. I remember that. I was like, Jeremy, can I see the carbon? He's like, no. I'm like, come on. Let me just film it.
Come on. That's cool. But honestly, all the bow companies make really great bows. You just got to go and shoot them. You know, forever. Sure. Matthews, I could not get to torque tune to save my life. But those, they were great turkey bows for me. So I shot a Matthews for turkey. But gosh dang, I couldn't get those things to torque tune.
Now,
and
is your like, so if I was to go to your like lab, right? Your little bow lab, whatever you have there. Am I going to see like a ton of older bows, or do you have are you going out and buying like a new prime and trying different things? Like, how do you work when it comes to this? Since you don't have a sponsor, you can kind of play around and, you know, mess around with this.
So I've never shot a prime. I look at a bow and the first thing I do, do they have an 80 pounder? If they don't have an 80 pounder, then I don't even look at them, because the stuff that I'm doing in Africa and stuff, it's not about a weight. Yes, you could kill every animal on the planet with a 70-pound bow, an elephant included. But what you can do with a 70-pound bow is shoot a heavy arrow fast. And that is what I need. I need to shoot the heaviest arrow possible as fast as possible, because that is going to give you the most forgiving setup. So whatever bow I'm shooting, can it shoot a heavy arrow fast? So in my definition of heavy arrows is 500 grains is the minimum. Can that sucker spit a 500 grain arrow at 300 feet per second? That is kind of where I start. And if it can't do that, I don't even look.
What's your draw length again?
Because 31.
Oh, okay, so you got a long one, yeah.
Yeah, so I don't care if it, I don't necessarily need it to shoot 300 feet per second. We can dive into some different aiming tactics and, you know, and this, which is really cool. I actually think we should, because this is something I've been exploring a lot. And I nerd out on this a lot. So Dave, bear with me, because I'm obsessed with this, because I'm an inventor in the archery space. So when it comes to like the physics and all of this, I dive so deep into this. And I'm very blessed and fortunate to have access to a lot of top professionals that I can bounce ideas off of. And they say, Josh, you're an idiot. That's the worst idea ever. And I'm grateful for those guys. And it helps weed out the bad ideas. But then I get to some things and they're like, holy smokes, that is something that's worth looking into. And so I nerd out a lot. So let's nerd out a little bit with the bows and speeds here. So things I'm learning with this big high-speed camera and stuff when it comes to all this is, especially when it comes to accuracy, is penetration has a lot to do with stiffness, first of all, of an arrow. A stiffer arrow will out-penetrate a weaker arrow due to impact paradox, but you got to get a stiff arrow to fly straight. And because the most important thing for penetration is the arrow impacting perfectly straight. So that means you have to have a really perfectly tuned bow, which we tested all of this stuff on real live animals in Africa. Like, for example, Sarah shot a Cape Buffalo and it went all the way through the Cape Buffalo and buried in its offside with a 65-pound bow and a 430-grain arrow. And you talk to anybody that's ever hunted Cape Buffalo, 1,000 grain arrow, 1,200 grain arrow. Fill your shafts full of sand. It won't go in.
I mean, I never heard of that. That's awesome.
Oh, it's, I mean, they're crazy. Wow. All the super heavy arrow guys. Because I did the testing. I'm like, okay, well, here I have a 530 grain arrow, and there I have an 800 grain arrow. Let's shoot them in the target and see which one penetrates more. Guess what? The 530 grain arrow penetrated 35% more than the other one. And it's like, wait a second, why is that? And here's the reason. So if you look at, let's say, a bell curve, okay? And the heavier arrow you get, the slower the bow travels, right? Or the slower the arrow travels, but it has more momentum, okay? But if you have a 10-pound bow and a 5-pound arrow, and you shoot that 5-pound arrow, what's going to happen? The arrow is going to go whoop, have no energy at all, correct? So what that means is that's a very exaggerated example, but it showcases the point that on that bell curve, there is a spot where the arrow becomes too heavy and you lose energy. The whole point of the heavier arrow or whatever, all it needs to do is maximize the energy transfer from the bow into the arrow. And that is unique to every arrow or every bow and arrow combination, because if you have a more of a weaker shaft, well, that energy transfer is going to be a little bit different than a super stiff shaft. And you can learn this through tuning and all this. But anyway, the point is there is a bell curve and you can get too heavy. And so when I went to Africa the first time, I had a Cape Buffalo arrow and it was 800 grains with a cut on contact two blade. And we're going around and all of a sudden I see this really cool Impala I want to shoot. And I'm like, oh my God, I have this 800 grain arrow. And I'm like aiming to the moon to shoot this thing. I'm like, this really sucks. You know, I'm like, why can't I just use my normal setup? And everyone convinced me that it wouldn't work. And I didn't believe it. So I kill a Cape Buffalo and I start shooting my normal setups into it. And I'm like, huh, that went in enough to kill him. I'm like, interesting. So the next time I went to Africa, I said, okay, I'm going to shoot a heavy enough bow that to where I don't need to change anything with my setup. I'll just use my normal whitetail rig. So it was 550 grains the second time I went. And I got pass-throughs on Cape Buffalo. And I was like...
No, some people don't realize that their ribs overlay. So there's no space for it to just zip through. So their ribs overlap.
And this is when things change for me. Because I've killed probably 12 to 15 Cape Buffalo. A lot of Cape Buffalo. And I don't say that to be chauvinistic or bragging, but there's not many bow hunters that go and take technically arrows and setups that wouldn't work and shoot Cape Buffalo with them. So what I learned about this is like, I would get less penetration on animals if there was like a little bit of wind, for example, when it came out of the bow and the arrow would turn a little sideways and then hit the animal, significantly less penetration. Whereas if that arrow flies and hits that animal perfectly, it just goes straight in and has a lot to do with the energy transfer. And this is, it get physicky, it gets very physics oriented whenever you start talking about like impact and all this. And I don't know the actual technical terms for this, but basically what happens is when that arrow impacts, it's impacting something solid, right? But if that arrow is flying really perfectly straight, that energy transfers on impact through the animal because that's the path of least resistance. But now if that arrow is flying crooked and it hits, now that arrow flexes and it's got to go in, which goes back to the Ashby studies. And the Ashby studies is really interesting because Ashby, they did all that with like longbows and super inefficient equipment. And they did all these studies about like, you need high FOC and really heavy arrows and blah, 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 blah. And everyone, Ranch Fairy, all these guys base all their data off of that. And it's so stupid because that's all true for poorly tuned bows. If you're shooting a very poorly tuned bow, you need to have a heavy arrow with a lot of high momentum in order for that to carry through the animal. But if you get a very well tuned, perfectly straight flying arrow, it goes through everything. And we did this on this past trip. Yeah. I mean, Sarah again shot multiple Cape Buffalo, which is really cool, and one with the Beast Broadhead, which is crazy to think about. And so I killed, I think, five Cape Buffalo, or shot five Cape Buffalo, like four or five. I can't remember exactly how many, but with the Beast, 530 grain arrow with an 84 pound bow. And it was bearing up to the fletchings at like 60 yards in Cape Buffalo with an expandable. Now, our broadhead, we can get into that and stuff. It has some cool technology with bone avoidance and the ability to flex through bone and do all this, which definitely allows for that. Normal expandables can't do it, but it just goes to show you, like, we were getting really crazy penetration on very, very big animals without having super high setups. And so what's interesting about this is I'm learning more and more is, okay, well, speed's the answer. And I am going to say no, because you can miss faster, right? It all depends on how close you're going to shoot, because whenever I've been watching with this camera, the arrow leaving the bow, the arrow doesn't even start spinning until it's like 10 to 20 feet away from the bow. Then it starts stabilizing. So the faster your bow is, the further that arrow gets away from the bow before it stabilizes.
Interesting.
So if you're shooting 20, 30 yards, you're going to want a bow that's not shooting 320 feet per second, because that arrow is not going to be very stabilized by the time it gets there. Now, again, if you're shooting 20, 30 yards and you can hit something like this versus something like this, it's going to still kill the animal. So there's all these variabilities that you got to take in with what you're hunting. Is it a whitetail that can jump the string? You know, there's so many factors that go into it. But I can tell you this, you're never going to see a guy in Vegas shooting a 20 yard group with a 300 feet per second bow. I'd almost guarantee it. They all shoot crazy stiff arrows, big, heavy shafts. And again, I don't know this to be fact. I'm sure there's maybe someone out there, but they all shoot heavy stuff. And you're like, well, hang on a second. You just got in where you're shooting light is accurate and you're contradicting yourself. This is not, I'll correct all of it. There's a spot for all of it or a place for all of it. And when you start looking into this, a lot of it has to do with how you aim. So what people don't realize, and then we'll move on. I don't want to spend too much time on this because if you're looking at your pin and your pin's moving like this, right? What you're seeing is where your pin was, not where it is. Because there's a milliseconds of delay to what you see to what your brain actually processes. Then there's also a delay to your subconscious mind to be able to control, well, if the pin leaves, the pin has to come back. Pin leaves, the pin has to come back. So you're constantly seeing where the pin was, and your subconscious mind is actually bringing it back to the center. So if this is the bullseye and the pin leaves and comes back, you can't actually control that. You can concentrate all you want, but your subconscious mind is the one doing the aiming. And so what happens is if you shoot a bow really, really fast, so 320 feet per second, 350, whatever, the power stroke of that bow is so quick, you think the pin is here, the pin may be over here when you fire, and then all of a sudden you miss more. And it has to do with the arrow leaving the bow so quickly. And so what's interesting about this, which is kind of cool, when that arrow leaves the bow, your brain is still trying to bring that pin back. So you can actually build a setup to where it shoots the speed of the bow will match basically, you know, I don't want to say the speed of your mind, but in a sense, yes. So you can have a pin off center, and when the bow fires, it still hits the dot.
Interesting.
And this is big. Tournament people know this all well. This isn't, you know, news to them. That's why they all run lizard tongues and indoor, so they get maximum arrow contact as long as possible. Wow. So then they can bring the pin back to center. I mean, there's a lot to this. And again, we're talking about, you know, shooting groups like this at 100 yards is what we're really nailing it down on this accuracy. But then if you take in all considerations for all factors, because you're like, okay, well, a faster arrow is in the wind less, right? So if I'm shooting long range, would a faster arrow be better than heavier arrow? The answer is no, not necessarily, because a heavier arrow is harder to push off course. And so we went down this rabbit hole, all for me to say this: you want to shoot a heavy arrow fast for normal hunting situations, because normally in any spot and stalk situation, when you're going to get your opportunity, it's not calm, because you can't get close when it's calm. It's very difficult. So windy conditions are usually, if you're spotting and stalking and you're shooting 50 to 80 yards or 100 or whatever, you're going to be shooting in windy conditions. You want to shoot a heavy arrow fast, because then you get a heavy arrow flying through the air, harder to move. You're going to have more room for error. So building the most forgiving setup does depend on what you're hunting, but there's a lot of things in there. But don't for one second think you need to shoot a super heavy arrow that in order to kill anything and hinder your ability to shoot or hinder your ability to kill things. Because what happens is if you shoot too slow of a bow, your pin gaps are too big. And we all know this when we go full, when we range an animal, we adjust our sight, we go full draw, we anchor. Most of the time that animal's not in the same place when we did all that ranging. So you either be really good at knowing he went 3 yards, 4 yards, 7 yards and make that judgment, or you shoot a fast enough setup to where you're only going to miss by a couple inches instead of 6 to 10 inches. And that's when all these factors come into play to building a setup. And my God, we could spend hours diving into how we make our decisions with setting up our rigs. But there's a lot of factors that go into it. But here's one thing we do know. You can kill everything on the planet with a well-tuned bow and not high poundage as long as that arrow is flying perfectly straight. And again, Sarah did that with a 430 grain arrow on a Cape Buffalo. She shot multiple thousands of pound eland and went all the way through. And she was the first woman in the world to ever harvest a hippo.
Nice.
And did that with, again, 435 grain or 430 grain arrow.
And then my croc this year, which was slightly quartering, went all the way up to the fletchings.
So it passed through the first one, spot and stalk. Yeah. Complete pass through on a crocodile with armor.
Crazy.
And again, when you, if you ever saw our process, I don't even know if I filmed how to do this actually, but we are crazy when it comes to tuning bows. Like, we can shoot bear shafts at 50 yards if we wanted to. And so bear shafts and fleshed arrows. So our bows are hyper tuned, but it just goes to show, like, that's what matters most when it comes to penetration, but also forgiveness. Because every person, when you shoot, no matter whether you're Levi Morgan, Jesse Broadwater, it doesn't matter. If you're the best person on the planet, there's an error in your shot every single time. Because you're not a hooter shooter. Now, the guys that make the least amount of errors are the guys that hit the middle the most. But what all these guys have in common is they all make their setups to where they can still have errors in them and still hit the middle every single time. And what that goes back to is balancing your bow, stabilizing your bow, torque tuning your bow, tuning your bow in general, P-pipe. I mean, there's all these other factors that make a bow very forgiving. So even if you're off a little, it still hits the dot.
Wow.
And super tuning in your setup is most important when it comes to penetration and accuracy, for sure. Yeah, so the broadhead's definitely going to be 100% available, and everyone will have all their shipments by April 1st, the first week in April, so everyone will get it before their turkey season, well, unless you live in Florida. But yeah, so Beast is it. I mean, it's so fun when we first launched it, and we can get into the product and stuff and all this, but we did a soft launch in October. We sold out in 90 seconds, and then we did a restock, and we sold out in 30 seconds. And I'm like, oh my gosh, this is crazy. We just had a bottleneck with how many blades we can make, you know, because we can only make thousands of blades a week. And then I was like, well, I'll just open up a preserve your order and through our projected numbers that we were going to get until December. So this was like October, and we sold out in 40 minutes of everything. And so I was like, wow. And it was pretty special. We've had a lot of success and testimonies from our customers, and people are blown away with it. And so I'd love to dive into the Beast, because it's been a passion product of mine and David Hauser, our head engineer, for 3 years now. I mean, we've slaved over this for years to bring it to the market now. And if you're cool, I'd love to roll on some of the technology. Let's see if I have one right here. I might be able to. If I do. Okay. So this is definitely going to be the biggest advancement in archery. I mean, in terms of technology, since Rage came out in 2008, because pretty much every broadhead on the market since then has been the same thing, just wrapped in a different package. And they all have their tiny little variables that make them unique and better. But for the most part, they've all been the same. And so whenever I was looking at these, or whenever we were designing these, we wanted it to be different. And you're looking at it and you're like, well, that looks like a Rage or anything else that's on the market. But there's a lot of factors that make it different. And the biggest one is that it deploys at over 1,000 miles an hour a shot out of a bow. So right here, it deploys at over 700 miles an hour. It doesn't look very fast, but you can't actually see it deploy. It's, you think you can, but you actually don't even see how fast it opens. Anyway, we measured it, and it deploys at 700 miles an hour, which is interesting. So, and how we got it to be able to do that is through our spring technology. Now, we source these materials all over the world. For one, our blades are made in Germany at Lutz Manufacturer. We make the sharpest blades in the world in the broadhead industry. And we'll dive into that. I don't want to bounce around, but we'll get into how they're the sharpest and all this. But what's interesting with that spring is we couldn't get a spring that's currently on the market to work where it held the blades open like what we needed it for at the tension to do maximum soft tissue damage. And so we actually found the place where like Lamborghinis and Bugattis and all those places where their springs are made, we found that place in the UK. And those are the people that make our springs. And so it's all the supercar springs that are in those amazing Ferraris and Lamborghinis. Those springs, same place makes our spring. And so that was actually really, really cool. So the way this technology works, first of all, when you lock it like this, there's no collars, nothing. So it can relock over and over and over again. It's pretty cool with it. It uses our bolt blade lock, which interacts with the spring. But what's also interesting about this, it only takes 1.5 pounds to deploy. And what people don't realize is like Rage or any slip cam, kill zones, all of those, they have to have between 5 and 8 pounds of pressure to deploy those. And the reason is because the inertia of the bow firing, those blades slip down the cam. And so if you shoot a fast enough bow, it'll deploy the broadhead. And so they have to have a lot of poundage. And you're like, well, 5 pounds, 8 pounds, who cares? Like, what does that even mean? Think about this. Think about how heavy a 5 pound bass weighs. That is how much pressure takes to deploy normal broadheads on the market. Some of them are 15 pounds, like the crossbow versions. So you think about a 5 pound bass or a 15 pound bass having to sit on those blades before they would deploy. It's killing your energy. And it's terrible. But again, that's what people have. Because of our spring technology, it only takes 1.5 pounds to deploy our blades, which is really cool. We have curved blades on these as well. And the widest point of the broadhead is only 0.64 inches, which is narrower than a Sever. It's way narrower than a Rage. You get a 2-inch or 2.5 inch Rage, I mean, it's almost an inch wide. And that creates drag, which makes it inaccurate. And then what else is kind of cool is this is actually a fully modular broadhead as well. So this is 100 grains and it has an aluminum stud. If you swap out that stud to a steel stud, it immediately comes to 125, which is cool. Yeah, so it's kind of cool. But to dive back into the functionality of this and how it works, when this deploys at 1,000 miles an hour or 700 miles an hour, if you shoot a bow that shoots 300 feet per second, it'll be 1,000 miles an hour. If you take a sword, I actually have one. Let me just grab
my casual sword that I have over here.
I'm going to get one. It's a trophy I won bodybuilding. Okay, so this is a really good analogy. So imagine if I had a piece of fruit, right? And I press this into the fruit. That fruit most likely, like a tomato, would smash. And then it eventually would fall apart. But then the faster I swing this, the easier it cuts the fruit, right? So you think about people do this with samurai swords or whatever. The faster it swings, the easier it cuts fruit. It's because it takes less energy. It's more efficient. So on impact, you actually gain energy in terms of cutting the first layer of tissue because it's deploying faster than the bow or the arrow is traveling. And so all the initial cut on the animal is all used from the feral energy, not the arrow. So you retain enormous amounts of energy after impact, unlike any other broadhead in the world, which is really cool. And what else is really neat is these blades actually flex back. And I'm able to touch this, by the way, because we put a flat spot right here that's not, it's behind the leading blade edge, which allows you to be able to grab this and be able to touch it without cutting yourself. But when this impacts ribs, this can flex down, go through the ribs, and then it's completely open again on the other side of the rib. So you don't break the ribs, which again, have you ever cut a deer when you're deboning it and your blade slices a bone? Is it, what's it do? It dulls your knife instantly, right? Now imagine taking that knife, and cutting that bone in half. That is what all the broadheads on the market do. They hit the bone and they're designed to cut through the bone. And a lot of energy, one, for penetration, but two, you're dulling that broadhead so much. And so what happens is by the time it gets to the organs, yes, you're going to kill the animal. You can kill a deer with a field point if you hit it in the right spot, right? But you're getting a very dull broadhead hitting the vital organs, which causes less hemorrhaging. And so with our broadhead, when our blades get to the organs, these are insanely still sharp because first of all, the initial cut takes hardly any energy at all. We don't lose any blade retention on the initial impact at all, zero. And you could watch Lutz Archer. He did a review on this and it got 10 golden stars, which is the highest ranking a broadhead can get, which is really cool. And the blade retention on this was the best he's ever seen. He's never seen one have better retention in it. And I'll get into why it also has to do with how he got it so sharp. But the only other broadheads on the market that have really sharp blades hitting organs are over the top swackers, for example. A lot of guys like those. So when they hit the animal, they do initial cut and then they're opening fresh blades on the organs. Great market. Problem is you got a small entry wound. So then the animal is hemorrhaging internally, not externally. Your blood trails aren't very good if you don't get an exit, which you wouldn't very often, unless it's a deer and, you know, super close shots. I've shot swackers for a long time. Nothing against the broadhead. Again, they work well. However, not big blood trails, especially if you only get one hole. It's the only broadhead in the world that gives you a big entry wound, crazy sharp blades on organs, and you're going to get an exit. It's very rare not to get an exit. And so then what we saw, and we filmed this in Africa, and it was violent. And dude, Dave, I'll send you some of these videos.
These are not
on the internet for good reason. But there,
it's so graphic.
The blood spray is so violent. We saw a zebra I shot centered, projectile blood over 4.5 feet out of its body. I shot a Cape buffalo that stood there that had a garden hose of blood that was completely full stream, and he just fell over dead. Head on at 60 yards, and it went all the way to the fletchings. I shot an eland at 96 yards, and it went all the way up to the label, and within 3 steps, blood was spraying out of his side. I'll send you the blood trail, and he went and poof, fell over dead.
My sable was 87 and was dead within
seconds. Yeah. And the blood that comes out of these animals with this broadhead are so crazy. And a lot of it has to do with how sharp the blades are. And I know this is getting so infomercially, and I'm so sorry, guys, but I'm so passionate about this because there's just so much that I haven't even went over with how we ballistically matched it to field points and all this stuff. But I want to keep going if you got time, Dave, because there's more that I could go over. So the sharpness of these, the reason we're able to say they're the sharpest blades in the world is because we use a cryogenic freezing process on our steel, which is really cool. So they do this in the medical field. I don't know of anyone that does it in the hunting space, but the cryogenic freezing of the steel actually takes the structure of the steel and changes it molecularly by By freezing it at negative 90 degrees, it aligns the molecules in the steel itself to where you can get, it's crazy. If we do this, and then you can get a much sharper blade, minimum 50% sharper, literally 50% sharper. And so when you feel our blades, after they go through an animal two or three times, will still be as sharp or sharper after killing three animals with the same head than a range.
Which we had to do in Africa because we ran out of products.
Yeah, I mean, our customers on average are shooting two or three animals with this because they don't break either. I mean, look at this. Everything that breaks these broadheads, like on the market, like normal broadheads, the blades can move around. Every other broadhead, when it hits a rib, it damages the blades. Ours just flex and keep on going. And so that's what's so cool. But that cryogenic freezing process also allows for super high blade retention. So all of our heads, as long as you don't hit rocks or it goes into the ground, you can pick it up, wipe it off, put it back in your quiver, and shoot multiple animals. And what's even cool, we're going a step further with the broadhead, is we're actually going to include a sharpener in every package that's the exact angle of the blade, and a custom sharpener just for our broadheads that you can touch up your broadhead and use it indefinitely. Jeez. Until it is damaged beyond repair.
So what we're talking about here is, so just so people, you know, understand. So basically what we're saying is we're going to shoot the arrow with your tip on it at the animal. It's going to hit the side of the animal. It's going to deploy so fast that you're not losing any energy deploying it, right? You're losing 1.5 pounds, I believe you said. So compared to like 8.
Yeah, but it has over 21 pounds of stored energy in it. So you have a net 19 pounds.
So yeah, so basically what we're saying is you're going to get the entry wound and the exit wound. That's a large wound, a larger gash, than like say a swacker or a shank or something. And in that process, you're getting a super, super sharp blade that's going to do a lot of damage, not to mention go around or bend backwards when it hits bones. Question on the bone thing, what if it impacts a bone directly? Like just that's where you hit, it hits the middle of the bone. What's going to happen?
Great question. I actually just had this happen on my last buck. I shot him quartering in and dead centered the scapula, the ridge part of the scapula. I'll send this video. What happens when that does, when it impacts, these blades can be back and they flex all the way to their complete compressed position, which is 0.64 inches. So if you T-bone the scapula, you take a little ruler measure, it only has to send, it only goes through that scapula 0.64 inches. So a 2-inch broadhead compresses down to 0.64 inches and is completely redeployed within an eighth to a quarter of an inch. And I did a whole video on Instagram on this actually, where I showed, because I actually went through the ridge and through the flat spot on the scapula. It went all the way through and then came out the other side. The broadhead was still sharp and the deer died obviously really fast. But it's pretty awesome. Cool. But yeah, it compresses down to 0.64 inches. It's completely open again within.
Let's talk money. So what do these cost to consumer? How many they get? Like how does that work?
So right now for a 2-pack with, you know, a $15 or $20 sharpener, well, the sharpeners are coming at the April version, maybe a little bit after. So people that's ordered up until this point haven't had a sharpener, but we're including in this. Right now, people can buy it for $55. We may increase the price to $59, but they'll always be under $60. And again, you're talking about the sharpest broadhead in the world, Lamborghini springs and Ferrari springs. I mean, we're talking, even the anodizing is custom in America. And we assemble all of these ourselves in America. So we build each and every one of these, the quality inspection, all of that, which is not done on many broadheads. I know there's some American made ones that are great, but man, all that for $55, I really feel is pretty cool considering most broadheads are one and done. And on average, you can shoot between 2 and 3 animals with each head. So that would be the equivalent of buying, but I mean, if 3 is the number, it'd be like 6 broadheads for $55.
Yeah, that's awesome. And so, yeah, that's not even the most expensive broadhead by any means. So there's a lot of expensive.
Whoa, like iron wheels are like 110 for 3.
I was gonna say, there's a lot more expensive than that out there. So that's a good price. I think that'll work good. And all right, I want to move on to one of my favorite products you guys did, the nose button. So I know you've done it. It was a while back. This isn't like something new, but I don't think people realize how important this product is and how easy it is to use. Your videos on how to assemble it and put it on are so simplified and easy to understand. And the best thing about this product is it really helps you understand anchor points perfectly. And on top of that, for children, like, so my son did a video. I sent you the video on TikTok. It like 4 million views of him using this thing, right? It's unbelievable. I'm like, like 4 million views. Learning how to use the nose bomb. Like, okay, I mean, Josh can be happy, but like, that's amazing. But like, it's the perfect product for children to get them going. It's a perfect product for adults like myself. Like, I try to put one on every bow I do just because it's so nice to just hit that anchor point and call it a day, you know? But yeah, tell us about the nose button, you know, from your perspective, how it's been going for you guys. And you know, I think it was your first product, or at least one of them, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Do you want to start with that one?
Oh gosh, that's your passion. I'll chime in when I need to.
Yeah, the nose button. First of all, Dave, thank you for saying all those things. It's so nice to be recognized for that. And I want to tell you, I had this big, huge plan, and it was this great idea that I thought of all the way through, but it really wasn't. So the history of the nose button is kind of fun. I used to tie serving on my string. And then I would meld it to a point, and then I'd be shooting, and I'd finally get it to where it lines up perfect. And then the temperature would change the viscosity of the wax. And then my string would just rotate ever so slightly. And I was so annoyed. I'm like, God, there's gotta be a better way. And so I worked with an engineer. I said, make something that's got spikes all the way around it. I said, no one else will ever shoot this. No one's going to put spikes on their face. But for me, this is what I want. And so we did it. We 3D printed. I put on my bow. And I was like, whoa, wait a second. I was like, this is cool. First of all, it's super precise, which I really liked. But then what I realized, it helped me mentally before I shot. Because when I'd go full draw, it's like straight panic back then because I had target panic. And I'm like freaking out. And I'm like, boom, oh, okay. And it calmed me by having that kind of constant little indicator on my nose. I'm like, okay. And it calmed me mentally, which I thought was really cool. And all of a sudden I had a different tear in my paper. And I said, this is weird. And come to find out, because I was putting facial pressure on my string and I didn't realize it. And then when I put the nose button on, it gave me feedback to where I was pushing on the string and caused an error in my shot. And I just didn't know, which fixed all these problems that I had. And really, I just did it because I was sick of tying serving on my string and melting the string to a point. And so it's kind of cool. But to dive into the benefits of it now, please, whenever I say all these things, please know a lot of this I found after I invented the product. It wasn't before, so don't give me too much credit.
I set up a bow last year with just that. I didn't put no peep. I just put the nose button, and I was dead on. I was crushing it. I was like, why do I want a peep? It's always twisting in my way. And then you go and do the peep tuner. I'm like, this guy, bro. I'm like, this guy. Like, he's always fixing my issues. I don't know how. Like, you and I, like, share this mind thing. It's like, I have this issue. All of a sudden, I turn around. Peep tuner. Oh. That's what happened. Because it kept twisting. And I'm like, this is bull crap, man. Yeah. And then finally, I was like, I'll get away with it. I did away with it. And I was shooting dead on. No problem. And then I saw your video or something on a peep. I'm like, are you serious? I'm like, that's exactly the issue. So then, yeah, that, you know, I guess let's talk about that thing, too, because that is a smart, genius, easy.
Oh, thanks. Well, yeah, so the nose button, just the clip, the real quick cliff notes of that, you know, what people are like, oh, I'll just use the string. Well, that's a less accurate version because the nose button spike is 3 times more precise than the string itself. And people don't realize is you can have variances up and down the string as well, which could cause peep issues. And again, you can scrunch your face into it and realign your peep and you'll still hit the dot. However, if your face is not in the same comfortable position, you'll get what's called like peak creep, where you just start drifting away to a more neutral, comfortable head position as you're executing your shot. Happens a lot in the tournament world, which is why you see a lot of high-end professionals using the product. And I don't even sponsor all of them. You know, these guys use these things on their own. And so it's really cool. So it fixes that, but also it's the only product in the world that I know of that gives you real life feedback before you shoot. and tells you if your shot's off. Because you draw back and you anchor on a deer, and all of a sudden your nose button is like hitting up here. And you're like, well, wait a second. And you're like, oh, most guys in that situation would have shot and hit him in the shoulder, hit him in the guts, backstrapping him.
So many times that would have fixed issues in our past. So many times. Like
Sorry, I get so excited. I get so passionate about it. I didn't mean to cut you off.
Yeah, I just remember, you know, Brian, my cousin Brian, bought this new Matthew switchback. I'll never forget it. And he gets all excited about it. We go hunt on this public state land in Michigan. And he's sitting there and he draws the bow. And, you know, the buck comes in, he draws the bow. And he, you know, you're on an angle in a tree stand. So the angle, he angled it like this, right? He was so excited and freaking out. He went up instead of like put it on there because he had no nose button type thing to help him align correctly. He got rid of his kisser button. That was the other thing. The pro shop talked him out of it. Like, no one uses kissers anymore. So he's like this. He's like, all right, he fires, misses this buck. Another minute goes by. He's freaking out. He's like, I can't believe I missed. Another deer comes in and he misses that one.
Oh, no.
He's like, this bow sucks. I'm like, I don't think it's the bow, man. I'm like, But this is a good example of like when this was years ago, but this, like, man, this is the type of thing that would have been perfect for that, you know, just perfect. So
fun. Yeah. And most people, they go in their backyard and they hit the dot every time. They think that's going to translate to hunting, and it doesn't. Because in the backyard, you're on even ground, you're comfortable, you're relaxed. There's no stress element put into this, no adrenaline, no tension in your body. All these things play factors in you missing on the animals. And there is not I can literally count probably on one hand how many times I've shot an animal in a comfortable position. I'm always in the ground blind. He's never where he needs to be. Or I'm up in a tree stand in a weird angle. He didn't come in my shoot lane. He's over here.
In the bushes.
And it's always in the bush. You're like, what the heck? And so you're never comfortable. And it just shows you that error. But what a lot of guys, I didn't think of this until after it already happened and I realized it fixed an error, is whenever you get in compromised positions, you compromise your head position in order to get to the peak and pin alignment. So you push into the string. But what people don't realize, when your bow, it says 85% let off. What that actually is saying is that means 85% of your string tension at full draw is gone, which means that is a limp noodle. You can go full draw and you can run your peep up. You can pull the string apart at full draw because there's no resistance at all. To do this sometime, have someone go full draw and then just squeeze their string, move it back and forth. It will shock you on how easy it moves. So the second that string is no longer in a perfect alignment and you put facial pressure into that string has to come back to straight before it leaves the arrow. And so now that string is now crooked because you pushed into it. It comes back straight. That arrow goes right into your arrow and causes a off tear, a left hit. And if you're using a fixed blade, oh my God, you are going to miss worse than like a tighter expandable. But again, facial pressure is huge with these new bows, with these high let offs. And again, it fixes that because it gives you real life feedback. When you push into the string, it hurts. So you barely touch it. And you know.
So how did this get into the peep tuner then? Like, take us into where that came from then, you know, going from that to this.
Yeah. So the peep tuner was cool because I was always the guy that put D-loop string up there, you know, but then the D-loop string would press it and it annoyed the crap out of me and I could never get my peep right. A quarter turn would do too much. Or a half turn, I could never get it square and it drove me crazy. And so I was just like, well, if a D-loop works, I wonder if I put something bigger in there. And so I just started prototyping it with peep tuner or with plastic pieces. And sure enough, it changed the rotation of the peep. And this actually happened where it really came into fruition was when we went to Africa, Mozambique for the first time, because the temperature differences, what people don't realize when you go from cold to hot, the viscosity of the wax changes, which changes the density of the string, which causes rotation differences. People experience this if they shoot their bow indoors and then they go out in the winter and shoot and all of a sudden their peep's off. And they're like, why is that? Well, the string tension's different. And so what this peep tuner does is it separates the string, which then causes the peep to change its rotation. And so if the peep is rotated to the right, you can put a peep tuner down low at the other end. If it's rotated to the left, you put it up top, and then you could just move these back and forth, and it'll orient the peep to be exactly perfect.
Yeah, that's,
and it's pretty
cool. That's really cool, man. That was one of my favorite things. Those, I'll be honest, every one of your products, that's why I know I'm going to like the broadhead, because everything is like, oh, this works so good every time. And then I'm like, oh, the broadhead? I'm like, this thing is not going to be a normal broadhead. There's going to be something special about it. There's no way. Josh would never put something out unless it was freaking lit. So it's going to work. Thanks, I can't wait.
Well, I'm my own customer, you know, and my wife, and we're in dangerous situations too, where if there's a failure of anything and a Cape Buffalo stomps her to death, you know, there's a lot of things that go in factors of this, but I'm my own customer too. And I got to give a huge shout out to David Hauser. You know, he's a business partner of ours with Boma Archery and Beast Broadheads, and he's the head engineer, very accomplished archer as well. And so he also brings a lot of this stuff to life. And so he wasn't a part of like the nose button, but he came on with the peep tuner and the, which is super cool. And then the Beast Broadhead has been our brainchild, you know, together. That's the one, but we've got a lot of cool stuff that we're working on too, that I can share, just not yet.
All right, guys. Well, thank you for joining me. I appreciate it. I know there's still a lot more to talk about. I'm thinking we're going to do another episode, because I want to talk to you guys at a different time, but about the nutrition stuff as well, because I think it's very important for outdoorsmen and women to understand like workout stuff and eating correctly and things like that. I think it's a really important episode in its own, in my opinion. So congratulations on the journey. I think you guys have done an amazing job with what you've done, with especially with social media and all the products, and you know, really just owning it yourself, like saying, you know what, I don't need these people. I'm just gonna do it myself, and I'm gonna get behind myself and do it. I think that's an amazing thing, and much respect for that. So thank you so much for doing this.
Thanks, Dave. Yeah, I appreciate it. And again, you know, it's a labor of love, and I'm excited to do this, and I hope we can do it again. If you ever want to talk to big bucks and, you know, strategies there, I mean, Sarah could do a whole podcast and just the stuff she's been hunting since she started. I mean, it's pretty special what she's accomplished with bow and arrow. And dude, I'd love to be back on. Thank you.
Thank you both.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.